Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Seeking Human podcast. We are super excited this time to be joined by professional nerd. You told me not to say that, but I'm doing whatever I'm told not to do. Hannah Fry, who is calling in from the UK. She's an author of Hello World. She is a mathematician. She's a BBC podcaster, journalist, renovationalist. What is that?
I think that works.
It works, right? You do renovating and you're a renovationist. Hannah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Are you really excited?
You know what? I'm struggling to remember a time I've been more excited.
Oh my gosh, that's great. We can't wait to get going. So before we even really get started, because we really wanted to, we started with the fact that you're a nerd. Mm-hmm. Why don't you share with us what you're doing with your renovation?
My ultimate nerd trophy that yes. I somehow acquired.
Yes.
Okay, so I don't know if you've seen Alex Garland did this TV series called Devs, and it was amazing. It was all about free will and about quantum computers and about whether the universe is deterministic. It's like the ultimate sort of nerd treat. Anyway, the central character in that series is a quantum computer, and it's really beautiful. It's like gold and spindly and twinkly, and it moves around and it's absolutely amazing. It looks very much like the real IBM quantum computing cooling stack. It looks really similar to that. Anyway, somehow, and I'm still not quite sure how, I now own it.
What do you mean you don't know how? It just appears. Ta-da, open the front door. There it is. There is the giant quantum computer.
I mean, sort of. I was like in a room when a conversation was happening where a couple of people were like, we don't know what to do with this quantum computer. And I was like, well, I'll have it. I mean, obviously, why not? Sort of kind of not serious, but also, I mean, you're not going to turn it down, are you? And then all of a sudden, I had this like production manager emailing me, handing over details about the storage unit it was in, all of this different kind of stuff. Anyway, so the reason why I'm going ahead with this is that I'm doing up my house. That's why I'm a renovationist. And just the way that we're doing up our house, we've got like this house is very thin, but it's very tall. So we're like doing this little vault, like a two-floor vault. And we're going to dangle this quantum computer from the ceiling, like the most elaborate chandelier that has ever existed, over our two-story vault in our house. And it's the most stupid thing I have to take the wall off my house to get it in.
Is it purpose-built, or are you actually building your house around this ridiculous computer?
I mean, sort of. You know how people say, like, renovations, once they get started, they sort of take on a life of their own and they get really out of hand?
Yep.
I mean, that, but plus a quantum computer.
That is
but
ridiculous.
Anyway, you know, I do like the idea of one day sitting there in my kitchen, you know, sipping a glass of something cold and looking up at this like omniscient being.
Now that we're getting into this whole podcast, what I want to do is to get things started, we're going to put you on the spot and we're going to make you finish this sentence. AI will dot, 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 dot.
You're really leaving that open-ended there, aren't you?
Super open-ended. Yeah.
All right, so I think that there's that old saying that when it comes to new technology, we tend to underestimate the long-term impact of it and overestimate the short-term impact. Mm. And I think that it's also true of AI, right? I think that, like, especially when, you know, the latest machine vision came into being and everyone was very excited and everyone started talking about Terminator again, I think all of that stuff is sort of more fantasy than reality, I think, certainly in the short term. But I do think that something has really fundamentally changed about our world with the explosion of data and with the capacity to be able to analyze it in the way that just, you know, even a really short time ago was just beyond fantasy. I think that our world has fundamentally changed. And I think that AI has a really big part in that.
Has it accelerated in the last few years? Do you see it picking up the AI assistance, or is it just steadily, exponentially, like technology just continuing along?
I think it is gathering pace. I do think that you are on these exponential curves. I think you're right. I mean, it's like Moore's law is the one that everyone used to talk about, you know, of the sort of the physical limitations of what could be computed based on the way that you can design processes. And I think that now we're really at a stage where actually processing power isn't really an issue anymore. And like data collection, having big gaps in data isn't really an issue anymore. And I think that we are still at a point where people are still... I guess like techniques are finding their feet, as it were. But I think that this stuff is only going to increase. I think, you know, we're on a one-way street, basically.
Your whole premise of your book, when I was reading the book, which is amazing for me because I have an attention span of a goldfish. So finishing the book is good, especially on a Kindle, because it reminds you where you are when you come back to it. But you have so many great stories in this book that talk about how AI is already helping us. Are there any favourites that you go, I love that?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's so many. Okay, so actually my favorite story about how AI is already helping us, I think it's not in my book, but it's like, it's my favorite thing ever. Okay, so it's the story that starts with this... if you look at the data for the ratio of baby boys and baby girls, right, and you look at it, how it changes over time, there's like these really clear patterns that appear. So the first is that it's not 50-50, right? Slightly more baby boys are born than girls. And the second thing is that this ratio really changes very dramatically over time. And in particular, in pretty much whichever country you go to, there is a spike in the number of baby boys that are born immediately after a war. Okay, now this is like this really strange phenomenon, right, that people were like, what the hell is going on? Anyway, it turns out that the reason why this happens is that the chances of conceiving a male or a female child, they change really, really subtly depending on when in your cycle you conceive, right? So ever so slightly earlier means you're ever so slightly more likely to have a baby boy. So this is like tiny, right, tiny probabilities here. So you can't really... game this if you
yeah
if
I was
you
gonna
want
say
to.
Can you program it?
You can't really, like, at the level of an individual you can't really do it, right. But when you scale up to a population, you see this pattern really clearly. Anyway, turns out some scientists are doing some investigations. Turns out, right, the same is true of cows. So that the cows, the chance of a cow conceiving a male or a female calf also really, really subtly change depending on when in the heat cycle that cow conceives. So this is something that you can game, because if you've got like a herd that is big enough, or maybe you've got stock that are sort of valuable enough, these are numbers that you might start wanting to play with. So the only slight problem, right, with like working out the moment for optimal insemination to give you a female calf, which is obviously the most profitable thing if you're a farmer, is that this window is really tiny. So cows are only pregnant for about cows are only in heat for about 18 hours. And there's no real giveaway that they're in heat, except for the fact that when a cow goes into heat, she gets up and she goes and has a walk around, just like a bit sort of stressed out. So she goes and has a bit of a walk. So essentially, you might see where I'm going with this. But basically, if you put a pedometer on a cow, right, and you monitor their step count, you can detect automatically this moment that they go into heat, and then like essentially send an alert for the perfect moment for optimal insemination.
Release
and like gain the world to give you more female cows.
What? Are you serious?
Cool, that's really cool.
How did you learn that?
Yeah.
I just read a lot.
Stuff.
Actually, there's a farm down in Somerset that I was talking to for a project that I was working on. And they've like taken this whole thing to like another level, right? So they've got essentially 5G connected cows, right? It's extremely impressive. So they've got like these cows, they basically wear like neck collars that have got, you know, essentially Oyster cards, which is like a London thing, forgive me.
I know that.
Travel cards, right?
Yeah.
And it like means that they can choose when to go in and get milked, and they can like, I mean, it's just amazing, right? Like they can go and get a massage if they want to. Like, I mean, the impact that technology is having on even something like farming, I think is really remarkable.
So you know where I'm going to go with this, don't you?
No, I don't think I do.
So if we can do it for cows, we can't do it right now for humans, but would it be possible if we had embedded technology within us?
What, so as in to improve our fertility?
Yeah, and timing. And so that you were like, right, get the probabilities right. And then if humans signed up for the study, which is possible, We could end up playing Mother Nature.
I mean, you say that we're not doing this already, but I think, you know, we sort of are, right? Like there are wristbands that you can wear that monitor your temperature and check the moment, and link to a smartphone app and tell you, you know, the moment when you're ovulating. I mean, I think the main thing in humans is like ensuring that you maximize the chances of conception rather than necessarily gaming it to be male or female. The probability, yeah. We're really tiny probabilities, right?
So we had a host once, Ellen, who's an Australian, and she's an AI expert as well. She was using the app and it inaccurately told her about her cycle and she fell pregnant. And she told us on the podcast. And I go, that's the best example of AI algorithms failing ever. Yeah. She was happy to have the baby, so I should have pointed that out.
Yeah, but still, that's the thing, right? Yeah. It's like the trust in these systems. That just to sort of extend that thought, there's an example that I give in the book about how we sort of think that algorithms that track our behavior online and that serve us up relevant adverts, we sort of think of this stuff as quite innocuous. We sort of think of it as not particularly, you know, there's no heart. Okay, so there's a pair of slippers that stalk me around the internet. Like, who really cares? But actually, there are lots of stories now of women who had a miscarriage or maybe even a stillbirth, and that sort of virtual pregnancy continues on without them. And, you know, when it comes to the due date, they're served adverts about, you know, cots and baby blankets and all of this different kind of stuff. And I think that's really like, there's something really like deeply upsetting about that, actually, when technology can go wrong in that way.
Yeah, you mentioned that because you talk a lot about the manipulation that can come and how the advertising work and how these data brokers are working and selling your information and how much information they have on you. That's where you sort of get to the whole like, well, you should have to explain the algorithm and you should, as a person, potentially have control to be able to turn it off.
I definitely think that's the key point. So this is something I noticed myself, actually. So I had cancer quite recently. I'm all fine now, but had cancer. And I noticed, I have, you know, ad blockers up to my eyeballs, right? Like, I never accept cookies. I'm really careful as far as I possibly can be. And I'm quite tech savvy too, right? Like, as far as I possibly can be, I am very careful to minimize the amount of intrusion of these algorithms. And yet, inevitably, if you're Googling what happens when you have this cancer, whatever, like this kind of stuff, you know, you see the repercussions of that in the things that you're served. And the big thing that I noticed was I would go on TikTok just to like watch a few videos, pass some time, you know, take your mind off things. And TikTok started serving me cancer videos, cancer video. And it was like, I don't want this. Like, this feels really invasive. Mm. And you need to have, it's like you feel like you want to have a button where you say, okay, like, turn this off. Like, this feels really invasive. And I think that if you had, I don't think that the algorithms about, you know, the adverts that you're served necessarily need to be completely transparent. I think you need to know what people know about you and have the option to turn it off. I think that's really the big thing.
Yeah, and it's not very well broadcast. I mean, you know, accept cookies. No one's read like the clicking of accept cookies all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't know what happens if you don't hit okay. I'm guessing, Hannah, you don't hit okay.
I don't hit okay. And it's very interesting, actually, because some websites are quite decent about it. Yeah. And they're like, do you always hit okay, Dave? Do you always hit just have them?
Oh, no, I feel really bad now. But yeah, I just go, yeah, all right, whatever. You already know enough about me. It's too late. And now I'm like,
just have it.
I know. And now I'm like, after reading your book, I started going, oh, yeah, you know, maybe she's right. Maybe I should use a different browser. Maybe I should do blocking. And
I was
teaching the kids about, like, I started blocking them from using YouTube because they started talking to me like they were a YouTuber. And I went, no, this isn't okay. No, well, because we learn on YouTube, you know? And they're like, oh, this isn't right.
What do you think, Claire? Do you click them?
Not all of them, no. So
not all of them. Yeah. Does it depend on the website?
Yeah, it depends on the website. I don't necessarily trust it. A bit more suspicious, I guess.
HannahFry.com.
But if it's like a favorite clothing store, I do. But something where I don't use it regularly.
Yeah, so you basically go to the clothing store website and you go, yep, follow me around because I'm going to need some shoes. I'm going to need jackets. I like that. Yep. Three, look, it's telling me to get the dress.
But
I'm just going to get it.
All the foreign ones? Not really. No, I don't.
You know, the thing is, though, I think it's like we're now in this society where to opt out of this stuff means you have to go to such extreme lengths. So a couple of years ago, while I was researching the book, actually, I went to something called a crypto party, right? Which is, it's a lot less fun than it sounds.
Yeah.
But essentially, it's a place where you go and a group of like very technically minded people will explain to you how to avoid, how to evade all kind of tracking, right? So obviously things like, you know, using the communicating via the dark web, like sort of obvious stuff like that, and like having ad blockers and whatever. But there were even people who were like, no, what you need to do is you need to have a version of an operating system on a USB stick that you plug into your computer, and then you can plug into a computer, it boots up an entire operating system for you, and then when you leave, it all goes, right? So it's like you never existed. And I was like finding all this stuff really interesting, but mostly I was looking around this room at all the other people who were there at this crypto party, just being like, what do you have to hide? Like, what is it that you're so secretive about? Because I mean, inevitably, right? Like your mind just is like, and that's the strange thing. I don't want to be tracked, but I'm suspicious of people who don't want to be tracked.
But that's what I've always thought. That's why I hit okay, right? Because I'm like, oh, I don't care if this, you know, guitar Fender want to follow me around. I want to get a Fender at some point. So I'm cool with that. I'll just hit okay, okay, okay. And eventually you go, what's that Pearl Jam song? In Too Deep, Can't Touch the Bottom. I'm like, it's like, you got everything you want on me.
But until
pretty
you
much.
Do care, I think. You
starting
don't,
to.
You don't care yet because you haven't had something affect you. You know, something happens to you perhaps where something really bothers you.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Well, you gave a good example also in the book about privacy and crime. So you were showing how algorithms are being used in the police force to proactively sort of prevent and predict crime, right? But then there was this sort of yin yang where you go like, yeah, but also we need facial recognition software in order to do it, which means we've got to capture a lot of people's information. And I think one of the stats in your book was like half of the American population.
Oh yeah, it's more than that now.
I was going to say that this is probably now all of the American population and most of the UK population. And then it comes down to like, well, if you've got nothing to hide, then why should you worry? Or should you worry?
I just don't know. I mean, I think these are questions that are like so big. These are such massive societal questions of like, where do you draw the line between, you know, potentially preventing a crime from occurring and protecting the rights of innocent people from being accused of crimes that they didn't commit? Like, where do you, because there has to be, at some point, you have to draw that line, right? Like, we know in the way that we construct judicial systems, you know, in Western society, we have like innocent till proven guilty, beyond reasonable doubt. Like, we accept that these are not certainties. We accept that you're not going to get it right every single time. There have been like numerous people who've spoken in the past about how many innocent people you'd be willing to lock up to ensure that you prevented a certain number of crimes, right? Like, this is a genuine balance that people have to think about. And I think what's really troubling about the current situation that we're in now is that these are also things that people have to think about, but they're conversations that are happening behind closed doors in private tech companies between individuals who are not elected or who don't even really necessarily have the sort of training and background in these giant questions to be able to answer them. You know, we're talking about people who are mathematicians and computer scientists who are like setting little probabilities. And that I think is like where the real trouble of all of this comes in.
Yeah, because it's being led by, to your point, it's being led by media companies, by social media platforms. There's not a government body per se. Maybe there is, but they're not going fast enough and they're not loud enough. And I think in the book you called it quite rightly the Wild West at the moment, where it's like your data can go anywhere. You've got algorithms that can do anything. For the most part, we're doing good with them. We're trying to do good with them. They're not necessarily being produced for evil, but there is that chance that elections are being manipulated, which we all have come to see that that was a case. And the media. So that one example you gave, I couldn't believe this. I had to read it out loud again. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Facebook experiment? Because this is, for me, ultimate manipulation of emotion.
Okay, so this is a very famous, this made a massive splash. People were really outraged about this when it came to light. Essentially, what Facebook were doing was they were trying to see if the newsfeed that you saw had an impact on your emotions. So what they did is they ran essentially sentiment analysis on the things that people were posting, worked out how many positive words they were using, how many negative words they were using. They essentially gave them a score, right? How positive or negative. And then they took a sample of certainly hundreds of thousands of people, I think, and they just slightly adjusted their news feeds so that they would see either slightly more or slightly less negative posts, and then monitored them to see if they went on to change the things they were posting. And essentially the effect size was quite small, but they did see this significant shift that people who saw more negative posts were essentially posting more negative stuff, right? Like that's sort of the simplistic way of saying it. And I think once again, this is like that example about the, you know, the pregnancy, if you have a miscarriage and then it continuing on, it's like most of the time, a pair of slippers or a mattress stalking around the internet, it just doesn't matter. And I'm sure that for most of the people who were involved in that study, unknowingly, incidentally, they didn't know that they were involved, this thing made no difference at all to their life. Maybe they're just like, you know, slightly grumpier one day. It doesn't matter. But it's the edge cases that you have to worry about here. And I don't think, you know, it's unanswerable. We will never know if maybe there was an individual who was just basically, you know, essentially on the brink and like, they log into Facebook to try and make themselves feel better and they see slightly more negative stuff. I mean, I am essentially creating a scenario here, but I think that these are the types of things that you have to be concerned about. You have to be concerned about the cases on the edge, really. And we don't know what the impact, the longer repercussions of that experiment were, or other experiments like it that happened behind closed doors.
No, and it's almost like, I guess with sort of Facebook, it's sort of almost a tipping point, because I've noticed it, and maybe I did it ages ago, but I just like, I'm sick of it, I can't stand it, I'll turn it off. But to your point earlier, you were like, what if you can't turn the ads off that are being served to you? And what if the ads are then, they've got your data and then they're manipulating you into particular thoughts because they know all the different things about you, and then they serve certain ads towards you, whether that's making you change the way you vote, how you, I don't know, I was trying to think of another really, really good example, but you get what I mean.
I think the big one, I mean, I think we all like to imagine that we're immune from being manipulated, right?
Yeah. Like,
and we all simultaneously like to imagine that people, particularly those on the opposite side of the political spectrum to us, are very easily manipulated, right? And I think that actually the reality is somewhere in the middle, that probably all of us, to a greater or lesser extent, are able to be subtly shaped based on the type of things that we see and the types of things that we read. And I think for me, the biggest one, the most noticeable one, I mean, the elections one is always a bit, you know, it's a difficult territory. Mm-hmm. But I think for me, the biggest one really is that, you know, in the past, when there used to be a moment of sort of great political discussion, we were all watching the same TV channels, we were all reading the same newspapers, you know, essentially the access to information that we all had was uniform, right? It may be that you didn't buy a particular newspaper, but you at least had access to be able to see what other people were seeing. Mm-hmm. And I think that that meant that when we came together to have sort of a national conversation, we were at least all sitting at the same table, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas now, I don't even know what other people are seeing, right? I have no access. I mean, I try as much as I can to follow people that I don't agree with, and like to read, you know, blogs and websites and stuff that is not in my sort of immediate sphere of the types of things that I think and the people that I spend time with. But even so, even when you deliberately go as far out of your way as possible to access that other information, I just think that we're like missing each other. It's a bit, I feel like, you know, certainly within the UK, especially with Brexit, I think that we were like, you know, playing tennis, right? And like aiming these perfect shots at each other, but we were just like all playing on different tennis courts, right? It's like, you can't possibly have a productive conversation about stuff, you know, when you're in that situation.
But isn't Brexit a good example of extreme sort of like, because the next day everyone came back out and started searching for like, what does this mean? Because it was like, they just were uneducated. And is this, what's the issue? Like, does this, it, can we boil the whole thing down to like, okay, what we need to do about this is start by teaching the kids. And we got to teach the kids. I wonder if they run school programs to help them understand how algorithms work.
Yeah.
How they're manipulated, and let them have a decision to for them to be able to decide, is this what I want to believe? Am I being manipulated in my belief here? Because at the moment, monkey see, monkey do. It's all real because I read about it and saw it on YouTube.
Or at least be educated to know they have a choice, whether they want to.
Yeah.
You know, whatever that may be. But like you said, I think in your book you said algorithms aren't good or evil. It's more about, you know, we're just accepting the, you know, face value. There's no accountability in a sense.
Yeah.
And is the issue because it's the IP? Is that the issue? Like, is it because you had a couple of examples and they were like, yeah, well, it's the IP behind the algorithm. And it was like in that example you shared in your book, you were like, it was an Excel spreadsheet that was done really badly. And it probably wasn't the IP they were sharing. They were probably just like, don't let anyone know what we were actually doing because we weren't doing it right. And it's like, uh-oh, we've been sprung.
Yeah, there's definitely a few examples of that. So that was a story about Idaho, right? Is that the one you mean?
Yeah.
So it's really awful, this stuff. It's really genuinely awful. So there's this group of disabled residents of Idaho who got the news that the Department of Health and Welfare, I think, had got this new tool that was going to work out how much money they were each entitled to in terms of their state benefits. So these are like people who were, they had very severe disabilities, so they qualified for residential care, but they chose instead they wanted to stay at home with their families and their friends and in their community. And so this money was like really important to them to keep their independence. Anyway, so this budget tool, it was basically like spitting out numbers at random, right? And some people end up with more money, some people end up less. They're like, what the hell? I have no idea what's going on here. So they got together, filed this class action lawsuit, and they'd sort of been told that this thing was this really sophisticated machine, that this thing was this really sophisticated, intelligent algorithm. Like, you know, they were kind of led to believe that there was this magic, beautiful AI.
Yeah.
And actually it was just a really crappy Excel spreadsheet. And my favorite thing about that whole story is that the formulas, the maths in the spreadsheet was so bad that the judge said it was unconstitutional. And I really love the idea of there being unconstitutional mathematics. That makes me extremely happy. But I think that, like, I think to your point about teaching this stuff in schools, I think it's not so much, as you said, Claire, right? It's not about saying, like, these algorithms are bad. Mm-hmm. I think it's a lot about demystifying them. And I think that, you know, at the moment, the techniques that you need to enter this world, like mathematics, right, or computer science, they're like over there in the corner with the professional nerds, right? Like that's kind of where it belongs, in dusty textbooks, you know, on the shelf. And I think that as the world is changing and embracing this stuff, you know, I gave you an example earlier about how this stuff is really integral to the future of farming. And I think that actually what we really need to be doing is starting to integrate this stuff into every possible aspect of the curriculum. You know, if you're doing history and you look at the data from the Old Bailey and you look at how language changes in the cases over time and, you know, how it used to be about how people used to care much more about property and now they care much more about harm against the person. You know, I think that if you're doing geography, you can look at like the data of how people in cities are changing and movement, you know, like I think there's like endless possibilities of integrating this stuff into the curriculum across the board. And I think only by doing that will you highlight just how powerful it is, but also really highlight how flawed it is too. And I think that by doing that, you can stop people really being led down this garden path and thinking that this stuff is capable of some kind of magic, as in the case of Idaho, right? Like the ultimate story there was not so much that there was a crappy algorithm. Crappy algorithms are nothing unless you have people putting total trust in their outputs and essentially making decisions about people's lives based on the output of machine. I mean, that I think is the real problem.
So do we need to get to you know how they have the Food and Drug Authority, or they have these, you know, government bodies that basically regulate the use of you know, different industries, building, whatever. So when it comes to algorithms, should they have to actually explain and say, this is what we're using the algorithm for, and this is the output, and this is how it's determining, I don't know, the output? Do you think could we get to that?
I mean, I certainly think that, like, you know, I certainly think that there are some analogies with medicine here. I think that, you know, in the 1800s, you could basically like get a green liquid and put it in a glass bottle and sell it as medicine. No one would stop you. But I think that we, over time, and it took a long time, right? It took probably 150 years really to effectively start to regulate the medical industry.
Yeah.
But, you know, we don't let people do that anymore because it's unethical and it harms people. And I think that, like, we are sort of in that situation now where you can just package something up in, like, a glass bottle and just pretend that it can do stuff that it just definitely can't do. Like, all of this stuff about emotional recognition, right? Like, there's so many companies now. I saw one the other day, this company that is selling software that you can be used in schools to watch children's faces and give them a score about how much attention they're paying in class. Right? Like, I mean, I find that so shocking and appalling, not just because it's like that feels like a massive invasion of privacy and all of the things that we've been talking about already, but also it's just based on complete junk science.
Yeah.
Like, you can't tell. You cannot, you do not, it's not like your inner emotions and your outward expression. It's not like a one-to-one mapping, right? Like your face is, you know, sometimes a window to your soul, but most of the time it isn't. Yeah. Because if it was like your face is revealing your inner thoughts always, then there wouldn't be such thing as actors, you know? like that wouldn't be possible. And so now that we've got this technology that's like based on these false ideas, these completely junk science and being sold as whatever, and people are buying it. And I just find that so astonishing. So to answer your point about there needing to be regulation behind all of this, I mean, I think that we definitely need something better than we have now.
Yeah.
I do also think this is more, it's more difficult than the case of medicine, because I think that sometimes there are... I don't think you can just rubber stamp something and say, this technology is okay, off you go. Because I think if you could, then Facebook would have got that approval in like 2006. And, you know, and that was like 10 years before the really sort of, they came into lots of criticism for what had been going on. So I think that sometimes these consequences are evolving over time. And sometimes I think the unintended consequences can take a long time to really become clear. So I think that this is more complicated than just an FDA, but I mean, there's a few different solutions that people are trying, right? And we've got to try something.
Maybe it's the next generation of politicians. And I don't know, I was just thinking out loud, but I mean, watching the thing that was going on, the Senate inquiry into Facebook and whatnot, and some of the questions that these people were asking, and it looks like they probably don't even own a smartphone. And you're like, so what is it that you guys do? And you go, oh my God. And you go, so at least, like, I don't know about you, Claire, but when I grew up, I didn't want to be a politician, and I don't know many people that do, but it seems to be a much older game. And maybe that's because of the generational gap. I mean, it's 10 years since the iPhone. Maybe that's the issue. I had this theory, and Hannah, you can say that I'm crazy if you think, but I think all political parties should have to have, because of this technology gap that's been created, you have to have a certain percentage of politicians in your party that are under 30 or under an age group, meaning they have grown up with technology, therefore they have a vote as to where we're going with everything.
It's ageism.
It's really ageism. But I just think this, we've got to do something about the technology gap. I don't know, maybe I thought that as a shower thing that I thought, you know, one of those great ideas.
No, yeah, of course, a good idea. Of course.
Practically impossible.
You know, I mean, I definitely think that we need to engage young people a lot more in ruling the country, because it's not like the older people are doing a good job.
Yeah. They're too busy on Facebook and TikTok. They're not listening anywhere and they don't really care. Autonomous vehicles. I was fascinated by your conversation about this, and we had this conversation as well about, like, we haven't even got some of the basic algorithms right, or even some of the simple things like, you know, autonomous trains. But for some reason, we're like fascinated about letting people get into cars at 100 kilometers an hour and expect them to be able to cater for all the different permutations.
But surely Japan's doing that. Like,
what?
Autonomous trains.
Oh, yeah, they're doing it, yeah, for sure. Right. I mean, some of us are doing autonomous trains. Someone reminded me, remember the train that went from that part of the airport to the other one? There was no one driving it. And I was like, what? No one driving the one-stop train?
But autonomous trains, I think that's so interesting. Okay, so autonomous trains have been around for a while.
Yeah, okay.
But I think the thing is that, like, in the world, the only things that are autonomous, that are, like, truly automated, are ones where the environment around them is so constrained as to make it appear as though they're autonomous, right? So trains, it's like they run on a track. Nothing else is allowed to go on the track. There's only one train at a time. You know, it's like, yes, in that really heavily constrained environment, they can be automated. And like, same with autopilot, you know, like the sky is not filled with pedestrians or like drunk people at 3 a.m. trying to cross the road without looking.
Or kangaroos. You know,
there's not like,
which Volvo had an issue with.
Kangaroos, right?
Yeah. What's that hopping thing?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. This is not, you do not have to worry about sky kangaroos.
Yes, no sky kangaroos. So, therefore, it's possible because most people would think an autopilot on a plane would be really, really hard. But to your point, no, it's a very controlled environment.
Yeah, because you have a global system of air traffic control, which is highly regulated, and you are essentially like point it in that direction and stay in that direction and keep on going, you know, and you have people monitoring the progress the entire time. And I think that, you know, it's only in that environment that you can really have automation. And I think that with cars, so don't get me wrong, right? I think that like when you have autonomous cars driving around a campus, for example, mm-hmm. which is again heavily constrained and you know tightly controlled in terms of where, you know, extra noise can come in from, I think that stuff can happen. But we're slightly sold this idea, although I think people have woken up to the fact this is not really going to happen, right? We've been slightly sold this idea that like I'll be able to in a short period of time, have my car waiting out front for me and drive down Lewisham High Street, right? With like all of the noise and all of the like kerfuffle and all of the people at 9 o'clock in the morning. And I'll be sitting in the back, like tapping away on my laptop or whatever. Like, it's just, you know, it's not going to happen. Certainly not anytime soon. Unless there are dedicated roads for autonomous cars, I just don't think it's going to happen.
Because I didn't know that, right? I did know that. I knew that the autonomous vehicles aren't really there, but I didn't know that some of the autonomous vehicles are in a controlled environment, like the Google one that you shared in your book. But the autonomous vehicles, then, isn't that another example of explainable AI? Like, have they got themselves too far ahead, made the public believe that it is possible to get into your Tesla or new Mercedes, BMW, whatever, and actually trust it and be okay? Because people are, I mean, recently someone did, they died. They weren't looking at the road. So they must have thought that this thing can do it.
Okay, but I think though, just coming back to what you were saying earlier, in fact, what Claire was saying, right, about how the real issue there is about trust. And I think that in many ways, this is the exact same story as that Idaho thing. Like, you had a crappy algorithm in Idaho and people trusted it, and then therefore it became a problem. And I think that actually having things like, so I drive a Tesla. I mean, I have it in chill mode. Oh, that's the kind of driver I am, right?
But like, there's a mode called chill.
It's for basically like old lady drivers like me. But like, the thing is that this, you know, what it can do, what those cars are capable of doing is filling in the flaws in humans driving, right? So like, things people are really bad at, we're really bad at like paying attention all the time, really like amazingly, not getting distracted, really bad at being like completely aware of our surroundings, and we're really bad at performing under pressure. And I think that like, when you've got this monitoring system in the background that's like looking out for danger and reacting, you know, without sort of feeling anxious or like suddenly panicking, you know, a sort of guardian system, as it were, then I think that's something that's really positive. Where the problem comes in is where people mistake that and overtrust it for something that it's not capable of doing.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, really for me, like, it's like that sort of interface between like humans and technology. It's not so much like how good is the technology, because I think that technology is by like definition going to be flawed, right? These are not systems that are perfect. These are systems that are capable of making mistakes. And so I think that like, you can push for perfection as much as you want, but you have to accept that it's unachievable. And then I think the real problem comes in the question of what happens when you start putting flawed machines in positions of power, and knowing that you can't trust humans to know when to sort of step aside from them, or humans have this like bias where they overtrust them.
Yep. You hit a really, really good point. And this is the premise of making sure that the AI is there as an assistant. And when you talked about those autonomous vehicles, you also included in the book that they're far safer than anything else, because they provide the beeping, the automatic braking, they tell you all these things that could possibly go wrong, and they eliminate many different accidents. There was like the example of Volvo that didn't have any accidents in the space of 3 years. So I think that's it, right? And then you also touched on, use the algorithms and the software to help humans with what we're not good at.
Totally. Yeah. I think this rhetoric of like humans versus machines, you know, will an AI take my job? That's like the way that this whole thing has been framed. And I think that actually you do much better if you stop thinking of this stuff as like a replacement for humans, as it's like, well, what do you want, the human or the machine? And you start thinking of it as like, what are people not good at? And how do we design technology to fill in those gaps? I think that's essentially the best examples of technology, the ones which I think have the best chance at like being around for the future. I think those really are the sort of shining examples, as it were.
I had someone say that example specifically. They said, would you rather be treated by an AI doctor? Would you rather just be treated by the world's best doctor? Or would you rather be treated by the doctor that's using the AI?
I mean, obviously the latter, right? Like you want that like human understanding of context and nuance, but you also want the sort of sensitivity, as it were, that is available from an AI. Like, I mean, I think we're now definitely in a situation where like AI is capable of spotting tumors and abnormal tissues, you know, and essentially beating doctors at being able to do so. I think though that there's like, that one is a really interesting point though, or really interesting scenario, because I think that like, while an AI is really good at like noticing abnormal tissue, so cancer, like breast cancer, for example, so breast cancer exists along a whole spectrum. So it's not like, okay, you've got cancer or you don't have cancer. It's like, there is this spectrum from, you know, quite normal tissue to like slight abnormalities, all the way through to like really nasty metastatic cancer. So even if you get AI that's capable of like noticing all of the various abnormalities along that spectrum, it's not quite like the end of the story. So there are some studies that show that about 1 in 10 of us is walking around with cancer in our body without knowing it. And that doesn't mean that there's like this horrible silent epidemic that like we should be really concerned about. The way they found this out, by the way, is they like took people who had died from like car crashes and stuff, and then like ran loads of analysis to try and find cancerous cells in their body, and like found, you know, I mean, this study's been done a number of times, and essentially you find that like huge percentage of people, big number of people, will have cancer without knowing it. And the reason why this isn't like this massive concern is that actually most cancer is dealt with by your body. So most cancer never goes on to be something that will kill you. Your cancer is, your body is like capable of dealing with it. And so the slight problem, right, with like creating this AI that is suddenly incredibly good at spotting even the tiniest, smallest abnormalities, is then you have to decide what to do about it. Because if you just treat every abnormality, you could end up with people being massively over-treated, right? You could end up with people being subjected to these really traumatic, life-changing operations and treatments without ever having, you know, the need to be. And certainly if it's you, the individual, like you wanna play the numbers to your, you know, you want to keep that risk as low as possible and probably would want to go through that treatment. But when you sort of scale up to the size of a country, I mean, it's not just universally, it's just more complicated than saying like machines that help us find cancer are better, you know, because actually you could end up causing more damage than you save. You see what I mean?
Yeah. I see your point.
I think, but because the machine will pick up the cancer, but the level, so it's,
yeah,
so dangerous,
to what extent?
You know, to what extent, whereas you want that doctor to be to dissecting it,
to make the call,
to make
yeah.
the call that with all the information, whereas you think that that will happen eventually.
No, so I hear what you're saying, but I also think of all the different, you know, in your book, you went through like medical, you went through, you even went through music and crime and just all these different industries of how AI is being used. The one that I think is the most important is probably cancer, and there's probably more. I mean, maybe that's just my own opinion, but I just go, haven't we been a little bit undersold on like the ability of AI to actually cure some of these diseases that you would think we could do by now? Well, I just...
How do you mean by undersold?
I just... If AI can do some amazing things. It can drive me down the freeway and change lanes for me and do all these other things and detect all these different cars and stuff like that. And I know the human body is a lot of different permutations, but it's also a fairly controlled environment. Inside, we're not that different. really. And any abnormality to a baseline should be an indicator that there is like issues. And sure, you do blood tests and they do the blood tests and whatever. But I just think with cancer, couldn't they be doing a better job? Are we seeing cancer rates go down? I don't even know. I just don't know whether...
See, the problem is there is so much randomness. Like, once you get to biological systems, you... Okay, so let me just... I'm sorry, I'm like... I've gone down a rabbit hole. But I need to tell you this story because it's like... when I heard it, I was like... My mind was completely blown. This is just like the... I think really sums up how... bodies are not these controlled systems in the way that you might imagine they are. So basically, it all comes down to some shrimp called a marmot crab, right? So a marmot crab, it's like a type of crayfish. It's quite small and it's like got marbled pattern on it. Anyway, they're like kind of boring, except for the fact that they've got this superpower, which is that marmot crabs can reproduce asexually. Okay, so basically, when scientists worked this out, which actually wasn't that long ago, they were like, hang on a second, we've got the perfect controlled environment here because you can create an entire army of genetically identical marmot crab babies and you can put them, each one of the babies, in their own tank, given the same amount of light, same amount of water, same amount of food, same everything. And basically, these identical marmot crab babies should grow up to be identical marmot crab adults. And then once we've got that, we can like start tweaking things and like see the ultimate difference of, you know, cause and effect of nurture and nature. So they did that, right? They expected all of these babies to grow up to be identical adults and they totally, totally didn't. Like, it was mad, right? Like, so they have these identical babies dealt with identically. And when they grew up, one of them was 20 times the size of the smallest. All of the marbling was completely different. They had different personalities. Some of them were more aggressive. Some of them were like more, some of them more like social. Some of them like preferred their own company more. Like their internal organs were like structured differently, like completely, completely, completely different. And I think that's it, right? Like you take a cancerous cell in a human body, yeah, and you run the clock forward. One time it develops into cancer, but you rewind the clock and play it over again. And basically you have no idea what will happen. You can't tell the difference between the cancerous cells that will develop into being something serious and the ones that will be dealt with by the body itself. And because, I mean, you cannot tell that. And I don't think that we're in a situation where AI can help.
Yeah, but Hannah, if you can figure out that a marmot crab can be social and they're using an AI to figure that out, more social than another one, then that's a permutation that I think, you know, most AIs then should be able to cure the cancer.
But, you know, I think this brings us back to like what we were saying about the devs, you know, the quantum computer and about like the randomness of the universe. And I don't know, maybe this is like getting a little bit philosophical and belief system, but like, I just fundamentally believe that there is this irreducible randomness in the world that you will never overcome, no matter how sophisticated AI gets. I just think that there's too much noise, too much random fluctuations that then escalate out of control via chaos or whatever, and mean that the future is ultimately unpredictable. So I think there's going to be limits to what AI will ever be able to do.
Which is a powerful statement coming from someone that is, you're very data focused, right? Mm. So that's something that you're...
Oh, yeah.
So that's... And I 100% agree with you. Like, I think the randomness is there. I mean, someone who'd be on the other spectrum would be like, no, if you throw enough data at it with enough permutations, you'll be able to figure out what it is. But in the marmot crab example, you're just like, nope, no, you can't.
Nope. Oh.
Hannah, thank you for being on this very crazy episode of a podcast. We've had a lot of fun. I have a lot of trouble wrapping up. That's because I'm really enjoying it and I don't want it to end. It has to end. All things have to end.
Hannah has a full day ahead of her.
She has to do things other than just sit here talk dribble with us.
Yep.
How interesting. I will close my book now and I'll stop talking and maybe Claire can say goodbye.
Oh, thank you. Joining us.
Thank you, baby. I really enjoyed myself.